It's now my pleasure to formally introduce Ellen Cadigan-Maisel, CBI Endorsed Professional, Perkins School for the Blind, and CBI Program Manager. Ellen generously offers such a wealth of information. She has presented at our conference in the past, and she's backed by popular demand. We're thrilled to have her with us today, and she will be presenting Cortical Visual Impairment Best Practice for Visual Access. Please join me in welcoming Ellen.
Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I really want to thank you for attending today. CBI is a real passion for me, and I'm just happy to share some more information with everybody from my point of view. And I think that all of us are on the path to learning more about CBI. We can't, in a sense, it's building information, and it's information we have to keep our eyes on. Very different from our understanding of ocular impairments. I think like we have that down pretty solidly. But CBI, I think there's a lot of work to be done. And I'm just so glad that you're all on the path to learning more. So I really appreciate that you all came to this session today, seeing as there were so many other really great things to pick choose from. The CBI theorists for a very long time have agreed on some central principles about CBI, that it really is a brain-based visual impairment, and it's of the visual cortex or the visual pathways. That's agreed upon by all the major theorists, that all children with CBI should be considered visually impaired. So this idea of visual processing can include things with disability, with learning disabilities, but those children that are truly, truly visually impaired within that visual processing group really have to be considered as students with visual impairment. So children in the higher ranges of CBI, we'll look at things. They'll look at things perfectly fine, and people will say, well, their difficulties are due to learning disabilities. But kids, people with learning disabilities have the ability to look at things at distance. People with learning disabilities have the ability to go to a restaurant and see a car and recognize it as a car, even though they've never seen it before. People with learning disabilities do not fall off curbs, for instance. So there's a really distinct group of things that we think about when we think about children with CBI, certainly at the higher edge ends of the spectrum, that all children, regardless of the severity of their CBI or their multiple disabilities, deserve vision services. So I think these are some very important principles that everybody is speaking about. They agreed that CBI functioning goes from severe to more mild. So I think in the United States, we think of children with CBI as the children in wheelchairs with multiple disabilities. So is that true for most people in the room? If you think of CBI, does that face come to your heads? I think it was certainly true of myself. I didn't understand how CBI manifested itself in the sort of higher ranges. And it's interesting, in Europe, they tend to think of the children with more mild CBI as the face of CBI. So it's a really interesting, an interesting difference that we're seeing in the field. That we have to screen all the children that we have with CBI for ocular problems as well. It's very common to see kids with strabismus, for instance. It's very common to see optic nerve issues with kids with CBI. So we really have to make sure that we understand the ocular issues that are going on with the children with CBI, because those obviously are impacting the information that gets to that brain to be visually processed. So that's really important for us to think about, is screening out for those ocular problems. And then we have to screen for CBI. And when we screen for CBI, that functional vision assessment has to be based on the problems that children with CBI have, not the tracking, not the scanning, but the attention to color, attention to movement, it's a shift in the way we take a look at a child for a functional vision assessment. So for some children, I may only use the CBI range, if they have no ocular problems, I may use just the CBI range as the functional vision assessment that teases out what the issues are around the characteristics. if I have a child with cortical visual impairment and ocular impairment, I'm absolutely doing both because both are impacting vision. Our best practice for kids with CVI is really to identify students. You notice I didn't say diagnose students because that's not our job. I think that that's a great misconception that somehow we can diagnose kids with CVI. I think we know them when we see them, and then it's our job to advocate for them to get a medical diagnosis. That's really, really an important part of this because that can act, that can really add to their access to services from Mass Commission for the Blind or some other services. That medical diagnosis really has to be part of the plan. But we can certainly identify students, and it's our role as educators to educate, to find those students, to identify those students, and the medical professionals to identify that student. So I may see a child in school that I know has CVI, but they've never been to an eye doctor who understands CVI. Everybody's had that experience, I'm sure. Or they go to an eye doctor who doesn't understand CVI and just says, well, there's strabismus or some other ocular problem without teasing out, does that issue explain the functional vision that I'm seeing from this child in this office? And that's really the central question. Do those two things match? Or you might go the other way, where the medical professional is then referring the child for a CVI evaluation to us, which would be great. Refer to a CVI evaluation. Again, you're going to be thinking about those characteristics which are an issue for the kids with CVI, not on the child with an ocular issue. So that assessment with criteria for CVI is very, very important. I do use the learning media assessment because I think that especially the sensory channels, it's my job as a teacher of students with visual impairments to understand how well children are using or students are using their compensatory skills and how they're using their, what's accessible for them today. So for instance, if I do a learning media assessment and I find that that child's tactile skills are better and that they should perhaps be a braille reader, I want to make sure that they at the same time have visual, I am building their visual skills enough to access print. So I'm really trying to always think about the child with cortical visual impairment as being a dual media reader potentially. So that you're really fostering that ability to read print. At the same time, you're giving them the accessibility for what their skills are today. And I think that's a very important thing. I think people will throw out things like the learning media assessment instead of just saying, you know what, individual children need individual adaptations, so really taking a look at that I think is very important. And then create strategies for increased visual recognition. This is what CVI is. Children with CVI see things perfectly fine. There is nothing wrong with their seeing. It's that visual recognition. So if we stick that in our minds, and this took me a little while, to fit into my mind, because we're so used to that, I'm certainly so used to that ocular view of kids, and really seeing this as an issue of visual recognition, not seeing something. So you hear me say that again and again, visual recognition. We want to be able to adapt environments to optimize those visual abilities. We want a program plan not only for that access, but for visual improvement. So for years and years, as people serving children with ocular impairments, we identified that ocular impairment and we worked around it with all our modifications, with all the accessible media to get around that ocular issue. We're doing that for CVI as well, but we're also identifying where the visual problems are and trying to foster visual improvement. Because remember, it's recognition. It's recognition of my cup and all the other kinds of cups in the world. My dog and all the other kinds of dogs in the world. It's really expanding and building that visual recognition, which is a true gift to be able to do that, I think. We really have to collaborate between medical professionals and educational professionals. They know as little about CVI as our field does, maybe even less than our field does. I'm meeting with some ophthalmologists and optometrists at Children's Hospital next week to try and come up. Tammy Reisman, Matt Teagan, and myself have come up with a one-page screening tool that we hope will foster understanding of CVI from a quick 15-minute office visit. Parent will fill out part and the ophthalmologist will fill out part. And the only goal of that screening is to refer for service from us, to get that child to a teacher of students with visual impairments that can really tease out those sometimes subtle kinds of visual behaviors. So once that's done, what we're really trying to set up is a collaborative loop. That old idea that I used to get the eye report, I understood the eye, I did my functional vision assessment, I served the child. It was kind of this doctor, me, serve the, it went like this. It can't go like that anymore. It has to go back and forth. I have to share my information, my functional vision information with the eye doctor, and I want that same reciprocal information back. So I think that that's a different thing for kids with cortical visual impairments than for the child with an ocular impairment. And we really need to continue to learn about CVI. This is a long path, and we are all on it. Thank goodness we all are on it. We're all maybe in different places on that path, but just to realize that we really need to stay learning about all the new things that are coming out. We're at the beginning of all this. We're really, really at the beginning of all this. So I just want to show you this little film. This is my little guy, and this is just setting up a collaboration. This is a set of twins, and I want you to just watch the film and tell me which boy, is he the boy on the left or the boy on the right, that shows characteristics of CVI. Is it that guy?
No.
See the effect of auditory complexity there? Can't handle his dad talking and looking at the same time. But this little guy certainly can. So these two little guys were born prematurely. They had periventricular leukomalacia, both of them. And only Omir, who's the little boy on the right, who clearly shows some characteristics of cortical visual impairment from all that you know about CVI. So his mom knew nothing about CVI, but what she did know was her children. And what she did know is that those boys were not doing the same thing. So she took both boys, because they had follow-up, took both boys, and the eye doctor says, yes, he has strabismus, let me give him some glasses, see you in a year. Clearly not a very deep understanding of visual functioning when it comes to cortical visual impairment, or some of the red flags of cortical visual impairment. Periventricular leukomalacia should have sent out huge red flags when we think about CVI. So this mom, she called Perkins, she got into the infant toddler program, and so I was able to serve this family as the teacher of students with visual impairments. But it was my job at that point to make sure that I wrote up the functional vision and shared it with that eye doctor. It was an educational opportunity, and it really could start this dialogue. You can't blame people because they didn't get this in medical school any more than you can blame teachers of students with visual impairments because you didn't get this in your teacher training program. We should all be trying to support one another's learning about CVI as much as we can with resources and more information, current information. So when we think about those red flags, periventricular leukomalacia is probably the biggest red flag that there is. That's all the children that are born prematurely. So it's not the prematurity itself that causes CVI. It's the brain bleeding that occurs afterwards that causes the damage that we think about. Hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, that's a lack of oxygen. You'll see that a lot written in reports. That's a red flag. Meningitis, epilepsy, any kinds of brain infections, metabolic conditions, hypoglycemia. The brain needs two things, oxygen and sugar, and this hypoglycemia falls under that category of not having enough sugar in that brain. So these will be things that you'll see in reports that should say to you, I've got to take a closer look at this child. Twin-to-twin transfusion, that's when one twin is getting less oxygen, less nutrition than the other twin. Any kind of stroke, cardiac arrest, accidental or non-accidental brain injury, the TORCH viruses, central nervous system abnormalities, and cerebral palsy. This is just coming on the cerebral palsy world's radar. They just are understanding how those children are impacted by CBI. And so you'll start to see a lot of this in the literature that's around cerebral palsy, is this understanding that they all need to be screened for CBI. Children with lower limb involvement, that those brain pathways run right next to the visual pathways of the brain. So it's just geography. If one is impacted, we really have to check and screen for the other. Same thing with the Rett syndrome community. This is just coming on their radar as well. Awareness of the impact of any ocular condition, and this is really important, and that's that central question again, does the ocular status explain the functional vision that I have from this student? So you'll hear doctors say, well, it's delayed visual maturation, and if I see that on a report, I will kind of, you know, probe a little bit deeper, and I'll ask the doctor, well, you know, how long does it take for delayed visual maturation to not be an issue anymore? And I hear everything from, well, about 9 months to about a year, that should resolve. So in my 41 years of being a TBI, I've had two kids that truly had delayed visual maturation, and it was incredibly striking. You went in one day to see them, and they were visually impaired, and the next time you came back, there was nothing wrong with their vision. In both of the boys I saw. It was a dramatic shift. It has to do with myelinization in the visual system. But so children will often get that diagnosis, but really I say to the doctor, does it hurt to put any of the strategies for CBI in place in case this isn't true? Because why would we waste a whole year? You know, why not? ROP, it's important for us to know where that retinopathy of prematurity, where is that damage? Does that damage explain the level of vision loss? Same thing with nystagmus, same thing with any optic nerve issues, or colobulbus, for instance, in some of our kids with CHARGE, who CBI is starting to be on their radar also. So just being aware of the severity levels again. And I think when I was just starting to learn about CBI, it was the child with no visual abilities or the child with inconsistent visual abilities that I saw as the face of CBI. And I would even, once they started to really look more, I would say, they're resolved now. Their CBI is gone now. They don't really need services from me anymore. That was a huge mistake because CBI does not resolve. You always have lingering issues left over. And looking does not mean understanding what you're seeing. That's the other, you know, through learning about that, that's the other huge piece that's come on my radar. Just because a kid is looking does not mean they're understanding what they're looking at. And because CBI is an issue of visual recognition, you see how important that is. So what do we need to recognize things in the visual world? These are just a few of the things. We have to use our central vision to look. And as vision professionals in here, you know that your central vision is very, very important for any kind of detail. That if you're using peripheral vision for anything, all you're getting really is color and shape, right? And everybody who's a teacher of students with visual impairment really understands how little you get using your peripheral vision. So many of our kids with CBI are using peripheral vision a lot to access their world. They have to have sustained gaze to understand what they're looking at. And again, kids with CBI are sometimes very brief, very quick lookers. You have to be able to shift your gaze between elements. So if I show you an item, especially a picture, I see your eyes go like this on that picture, gathering that central vision information from all parts of that picture. If you show a child something and they don't see that visual shift to the elements, they're not perceiving what's on there, especially not perceiving a picture. So many times people are picking icons for kids with CBI or picture symbols for kids with CBI that's way beyond their visual abilities. I'd like to highly recommend to people, there's a class being offered at Perkins right now. I took it last semester, and now I'm monitoring it just sort of as a TA in the class. It's called What's the Complexity? Really teasing out, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, really teasing out what images are accessible for kids. So really a great class. You have to have previous visual experience with an item in order to recognize it. Because when you have previous visual experience with something, then when you see something new, you can link those two things together. So if this is my pen, I can look at another pen and recognize it as having the same features as a pen. Again, back to that idea of visual recognition. And that's the way we understand what is seen. So it's that, we call it salient feature information. What makes a pen a pen? What makes a duck? What makes a cup? That's sometimes where our instruction has to be with for those kids higher up on the CDI range because their visual recognition skills are so fragile. So in the early parts of CDI, when children are very early on the CDI range, as we could measure that on the CDI range, the world, they see absolutely everything. But the world, they have no recognition of anything in their world. So their world is a kaleidoscope of meaningless colors, meaningless shapes. They lack meaning. And because it lacks so much meaning, they don't use their vision. Because it has no meaning to them. So why does a child with ocular blindness come into a busy lunchroom and is perfectly fine, where a child with CDI comes into a busy lunchroom and has a meltdown? Because that's an assault for the child with CDI. It's not just coming into a lunchroom and hearing just auditory. It's a visual assault on their system. So you get a lot of kids who, I need to go to the bathroom. They want to get out. They have all these escape behaviors to get out of these very complex kaleidoscopic worlds that they're forced to be in a lot of times. So just being aware of that's the lack of visual recognition. As children move higher on the range, they can understand their own thing. There's my spoon. I've got my spoon. But they don't understand that all of these are also spoons. So it becomes part of our job to expand that visual recognition, thinking about objects, thinking about things in their world. How can I expand their idea of what makes a spoon a spoon? How can they, when they see this brown spoon, have the visual recognition and the visual attack skills to say, okay, wait a minute, what am I looking at? That's got a handle, that's got a scoop, that looks a lot like my spoon that I use, that really, really links those things together. So here's an item that maybe no one has seen before. If you have, don't say anything to anyone else. So we can begin to visually attack this with what? What do we use when we visually attack this?
Visual memory.
Our visual memory, our huge Google search engine about what things might look like this. So any guesses?
Butter cutter.
Say again?
Butter cutter.
A butter cutter. So why does she think it's cutting?
Scissors.
Because it looks like? So that again, that she's, see what she's doing? She's linking what she knows to the unknown. Okay, because it has these two things, what do you know? Fingers. You probably put your fingers in there. Because it has this kind of joint, what do you know? It opens and closes. So do you see what you've done is that because you have such rich visual information, you're applying that previous information to something that you've never seen before in order to understand what it is. That becomes our role. Very different. This becomes our role as teachers of students with visual impairments to expand this visual recognition of what is seen in a child's world. Does anybody know what that really is? I like the butter cutter. That might be what I missed from now on. It's a candle snuffer. Anybody from New England, you should be ashamed of yourself. I always wonder, why do people have these? Like, you put it over and then you close it to extinguish the flame. Why not blow it out? Kind of silly things. How do we attack these two people? How do we attack these people and decide that one is a man and one is a woman? How do we attack these two people and say, oh, I recognize that person, I saw him on such and such? Our visual systems are so good that we can figure out the subtleties of that. Even if you didn't know these two people, there are such subtle, softer details of Gwyneth Paltrow's face versus Brad Pitt's face. But look at the same haircut, Their eyes are very similar. Their mouths are very similar. They almost the same height. It's bit, for someone who has CDIitis would be really, really hard for them. And that's often when we think about children's disabilities around CDI, well up into phase three, facial recognition is a problem. So how do we know all these are ducks? My two-year-old grandniece, when I showed her this, said, oh, there's a duck, and there's a duck, and there's one, and there's a duck. There's a picture of a duck. That's kind of a cartoon duck, and that's a duck. She went through every single one of them and could name them as ducks, even though every single image is very different from one another. Some of those images are different colors. Some of those images are just like a black shadow. But yet she has, at 2 years old, such a rich visual system, she can see all those for what they are. And so we have to be very careful that our children have that access before assuming. I think that's the big part of it, is we see so well, we make the leap just because we show them what we think they should know, that they really do know it. How do we tease that out? How do we make sure that's true? So part of it's prediction. So if I say to you, find the toothbrush, just raise your hand when you find the toothbrush. And where is the toothbrush? So it's on the shelf, and that's where toothbrushes are kept, right? So if it's visual prediction, if I said to you, go find the toothbrush, even when you're not in the bathroom yet, you begin to visually predict what you're going to run into. When you came in here today, before you got in this room, you visually predicted what was going to be in this room. We're constantly visually predicting. And we visually predict sometimes and ignore other things. Did anyone see that black toothbrush that's laying across the back there? Yeah. We did it. We did it. We missed that because it was not part of it. So you completely missed it. What's wrong with your vision? So this is why when we are teaching this visual performance, that idea of predictability for kids with CDI is very important. Predictable symbols, predictable materials, predictable sequences that the child begins again to recognize things in their world. So we have some CDI tools to do this recognition assessment. The only assessment tool that we really have for teachers of students with visual impairments at this point is Dr. Christine Roman's CDI range. I hope we get some others because we're in a field that we only have one, right? We really need some more. There is an interview by Dr. Gordon Dutton. It's a CDI survey. And there's an interview on the screening for Teach CDI. Teach CDI is an interesting website. But both these interviews are really used to diagnose CDI. It's like, it's an interview that asks the parents a list of questions, and if they answer certain questions in certain ways, then that ophthalmologist or that eye doctor can say yes, or that optometrist can say yes, they have cortical visual impairment. But neither of these gives us the severity level. Neither of these gives us a place for goals and objectives. Neither of these gives us accommodations and methodologies. So far, all we have is Christine Roman's. This is the diagnostic framework that I talked about that Matt Tejan, what's the complexity? That is, I think, a very exciting new tool in the field of CDI. It is not published yet. The only way, I sound like a commercial, but the only way that you can get the materials at this point is to take the online class that's offered at Perkins, and then you get the materials. Like, even today, I'm not going to be able to show you those real materials. I'll tell you a little bit about them because they're copyrighted and they're not published yet. But if you take the class, you have access to those materials beforehand. So these are some of the ocular visual impairment criteria that we might use that we are not really no longer using with kids with CDI unless they have an ocular issue. They are not relevant. So, Christine Roman, as you know, looks at those 10 characteristics of visual behavior. Those 10 characteristics are words that she has come up with. Color, movement, latency, you probably all heard those words. But those are well agreed upon by all the theorists. All the theorists agree with the same kinds of visual behaviors. They're just not calling it, they're not isolating it into those words that she has used. But she's not pulling this out of her hat. All the theorists are talking about these visual behaviors to some extent or another. But then she places those visual behaviors into three categories of severity, and she gets information from the parent interview, the observation, and the direct assessment. You can see with that little baby that we saw earlier, she's watching. Those babies were premature, like 24 weeks old. Do you think that mother isn't watching those kids like a hawk and knows absolutely everything that they can and cannot do? Even if she knew nothing about CDI, she can tell you how her child is functioning. So the parent interview is very important. Observation is very important. That observation happens in the regular learning environment, whether it's the home or the classroom. And then the direct assessment, you go into a highly adapted place where it's really quiet, it's really non-complex, and you see what the child's highest skills are. Once you know what the child's highest skills are, you can begin to make recommendations for the regular, for the inclusion in the classroom and how to make changes in the classroom that make sense for that child. So here's those 10 characteristics as she lays them out, and again, agreed upon by all the theorists. Preference for certain colors. People do not fall into the trap of thinking this is only red and yellow. That's, I hear that a lot. You have to do an assessment and tease out what their favorite color is. So I could have a little boy who spent his entire life with a Kelly green bear in the corner of his crib. Guess what his favorite color is going to be? And when I say favorite, I mean the one that supports the most visual attention. It's the Kelly green bear because of recognition. He's had it so long in his life, he recognizes that. So don't fall into the trap of saying, oh, all kids with CDI like reds and yellows. You really have to tease that piece out. They have attraction and movement in their environment. They have latency for looking, and very importantly, when we see kids higher on the range, latency for understanding what they see. They have visual field preferences, and some of that lower visual field problem lasts well into phase three. Attention to light, limited distance attention, or curiosity. Like if a child is in a classroom, what's their curiosity for the environment? Curiosity means that they're recognizing things in the environment. Difficulties with visual novelty and difficulties with visual motor skills. So she has the range, which I won't go over. The first part of the range takes a look at sort of a functioning level. So kids that are operating between a 1 and a 2 are very, very, very involved. 3 to 4, it's starting to get a little bit better. 5 to 6, a little better. 7 to 8, a little better. And 9 to 10, even better. FYI, and this is, I just apologized to some parent that I had when the child was very young, and now I have them as an 11-year-old. I apologize because I scored that child as a 9 because I didn't know what I was doing with the CDI range. And I thought, oh, she's looking, so I'm gonna, she's almost done with all the CDI stuff. That child is not done, and in fact, looking at the lens of a better lens of understanding the CDI range, she scores a 6. So that just tells you we're all on the path, right? We're all on the path. We're just trying to do this better. And then the second part of it, oh, by the way, this gives you right here, if you're writing a report, this gives you your functional vision statements. Is less attracted to light, can be redirected. If that's true of that child, that's your functional vision statement for the child. So any of the, from the rating 1, that comes right out and goes right into your functional vision evaluation for a report for a child. When you think about the rating 2 in the CDI range, that gives you your accommodations methodologies. So if I'm saying, well, the child's scoring about 5 here, I know movement is very important, and I have to think about accommodations and methodologies for the team in order to incorporate movement into what the child is or isn't doing yet. So that's a nice part of that for us. And then she gives us severity levels and then goals for each of those. You can see for the child who's seeing the world in a kaleidoscopic way, all you're trying to do is just improve access to that information. If you're seeing the child in phase 2, they're beginning to look, but their recognition is very, very fragile. Maybe they understand their own spoon, but they don't understand spoonness. What makes a spoon a spoon? When you get to phase 3, you have these lingering characteristics left over. They lack any distance attention. They lack distance attention because of complexity. When things are too far away, there's too much to look at, the array is too large. Dr. Dutton calls it simultaneognosia. You're probably not saying that right. So that's a lingering issue. They have issues of complexity. So they can maybe process a picture of a dog, But if it's a cartoon of a dog, they don't have dogness enough in their brains to make those leaps that my two-year-old grandniece can make visually. They have difficulties with objects that are in larger arrays. So the more things there are to look at, the less they can find things. So I'll have kids that will say, well, what color is it? So they really are still relying very much on color in order to find things in their visual world. They might ask mom, hey mom, when you pick me up today, will you wear red or will you wear your blue shirt? They really are looking for strategies to help them through these lingering issues. And again, you can see these are not lingering issues that would be impacting a child with learning disabilities. Very, very, very different. They also have difficulty in noisy places because using their vision in a noisy place is still hard for them. And they have difficulty processing faces, especially in a crowd. So this little boy that you saw as a baby, Omer, as a baby, his parents took him to New York City for a recent family trip. He spent the entire trip with his head down. He could not handle the novelty. He could not handle the different noise and the different sights of what were going on around him. He absolutely couldn't tolerate it. The characteristics themselves do not resolve. And again, this was a big misconception that I had. Because if you look at the CDI range, something like color disappears by the time a child scores 5 on the CDI range. But that does not mean that color isn't a huge support for those kids. It really, their impact of those certain characteristics may decline, but they're still very important for that child's visual function. Think about that kid asking his mother where red when she picks him up, or think about that child who can't look around on their family vacation. And they still have a lot of value, those particular characteristics that are areas of weakness, but then can also be used as areas of intervention as well. So if we think of something like color, we'll just do 3 of the characteristics just to show this point. So if we think about color, in phase one, there's often a favorite color that a child will look at, but also objects are recognized by color. And single color items support recognition. And this goes back to what Dr. Dutton talks about when he talks about simultaneous agnosia. I've got to learn how to say that word. So a child will look at something like this, and because color supports the fact this is all one thing, they can look at this and they can recognize it. When you give a child a multicolored thing, the multicolored nature of that item makes it look like you've got 6 things there instead of one thing. So color in phase one helps children understand that it's really one thing they're looking at. So that's an important support that color gives us. When we get into phase two, the kids still have a favorite color, but it's kind of they can look at the other colors too, but they sometimes still gravitate to that preferred color. And now they can begin to recognize that bear that's multicolored because they've seen it enough and they begin to understand it, to understand that that is one thing, that that is their bear. So they're increasing their recognition abilities. When you get into phase three, now if I'm looking at the CDI range, color is no longer listed on those statements. So you think, oh, color's resolved. This is what I thought, certainly. Color is not resolved. Color remains a huge part of how they operate in the world. So it helps them find things in large arrays. So they're looking for things by color in large arrays. Where we're looking for things by color and shape, perhaps, they're locked into needing things by color. Color helps them find things at distance. So if you're an orientation and mobility specialist, you want to be thinking about the use of color for landmarks in children's world when you're trying to teach them to navigate through the environment, because it's that color that's going to be really salient for them at distance. Color's going to draw their visual attention to the small parts of things. So we can use the color to highlight certain things. Like maybe a child has a very fragile idea of what dogs are. We can highlight the dog's ears, the dog's tail, the dog's snout, and begin to expand dogness for that child. When we think about spoon, we might color highlight the scoop of the spoon so that they begin to understand these are what makes spoons spoons. Again, you're building that, expanding that idea of recognition for that child. It certainly can help against complexity. And color helps identify people, as I've already said, with that little boy asking his mom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in a very busy drawer like this, the child's just going by color. Or when you want the child to put their math answer in the right place instead of the page looking like a war zone, just a little color highlighting lets them know, where am I supposed to put my answer here? Even something like, you know, you get those things that are like math minutes in fourth grade or whatever, just color highlighting the plus in yellow and the minus in red allows them to do it quicker, because the color highlighting has supported their understanding of that symbol. So let's look at movement. In phase one for movement, the child must have the thing move to see it. If it doesn't move, they do not see it. It has to move. Moving items will gain their attention and hold their attention longer. When it stops moving, they'll look away. Movement helps draw visual attention to the stronger and the weaker field. So if the child has a weak right visual field, for instance, movement will really support their understanding that thing is over there. When we move into phase two, movement gets visual attention faster for kids still. Those moving items can draw faster visual attention, and it draws, again, to the weaker field. But now what happens is, because there is more access to movement, movement gets noted at greater distances. So again, as an orientation mobility person, you want to perhaps use moving items in the environment, like a flagpole, to be the landmark that you use, because it supports their understanding of things at distance. But the other sort of bad thing about movement at this point is movement distracts. So any kind of movement in the environment, and the kids are looking back and forth, they start to fall in. People stop recognizing it as a visual issue, and they start thinking of words like distractible, inattention, where what it is a hyper attention to movement in their environment. If you eliminate that movement, you get great attention. You get kids that can work at something for 10 minutes. They get the diagnosis of ADHD at this point. You see that a lot. So, and really what it is a hyper attention to peripheral movements in particular. When they move into phase three, movement helps find things in large arrays. So if I give a child a complex map with a toy on it, they cannot see it. They bang the table, it leaps, and then they pick it up and they eat it. And I have seen this in many, many kids. And it's interesting to think, no one teaches them that strategy. They kind of figure it out all by themselves. But that's that banging of the table, which I think is so interesting to create movement. Movement helps find things at distance. Movement draws attention to the small parts, again, those salient features. And movement helps against complexity. So this is one strategy that I had for accessing a communication device for a child in phase three. So there's a large array of icons on the board. The speech and language therapist wants that child to learn the location of the items on the board. So she'll do a lot of modeling, like, we're going to go to, I don't even know, does anybody know what this is a symbol for?
Yes.
Okay. So she wants to point out to the child, this is where the yes symbol is on your device. So we just took a red pipe cleaner and just held it over this while she modeled, yeah, this is yes. And the child could have better visual motor skills because it was the highlighting color and it was movement in order to access that. And here's just a picture of that child accessing that. And so learning the location, basically, learning the location on the device. So here's just, this is a little guy who's in phase three. This is Omir, who you saw as a baby. He's grown up a little bit. So Omir is now 7 years old. He is he's going to be grade two. He is a math wizard, just really, really good at math, well above grade level. And he reads at grade level. But he has a great deal of problems processing any pictures at all. He does better with photographs. But if you do a cartoon, or you do a line drawing, he has no idea. But take a look in second grade at children's materials. They're black and white line drawings of cartoons on every single worksheet. So he begins to look like a child with cognitive issues because of that lack of accessibility. And we really need to bring that lens into the team, just tell them that this is inaccessible for him. or how can we adapt this material? So we're really getting at that cognitive issue, not his understanding of cartoons. So he's at the table. He's got a very complex book. His mom is speaking Turkish. Maybe he speaks Turkish. Maybe you can help out here. But so basically she puts a little Cheerio on the right side of the page. And you can just watch his reaction.
Hi, can you tell me what you think?
Can you hear that?
Page? Yep.
Huh?
Yeah, not a cute bunny. Aww. Peki bir dakika çevirme. Elini çek bebeğim. Elini çek. Bu sayfada ne görüyorsun Ömer? Kızlar ne yapıyor? Bak bakalım.
So here's the Cheerio for those with problems with complexity.
Ne yapıyorlar başka? Bak iyice bak. Bunny nerede? Bunny'yi bulmaya çalış. Bu sayfada.
He's saying, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know where it is.
Yok mu Bunny? Başka bir şey görüyor musun o sayfada kitaba ait olmayan? Ömer, bu kitapta.
He's probably thinking he's not so bright at this point. This is another thing I worry about him is his self-esteem. He knows everyone else in the class can do this effortlessly, but why can't he? So you see how that movement immediately helped him. Immediately drew his visual attention, immediately helped with his visual motor skills. We might hang something like this as a way for a child to navigate through the environment. This is a shiny piece of red. And remember that shininess gives the illusion of movement, so that's a nice support for kids. Here's a nice shiny classroom door indicator that one of the teachers put in place at Perkins recently after we had done a CDI eval on one of the children that was trying to find his classroom independently. By the way, I look down the hall and I don't know which room is hers. I'm like, oh, there's the red one. I know where I'm going. It really helps. So if we think about the last characteristic that we'll talk about today, where we have this really large span of skills, it's the idea of light gazing. In phase one, those children are stuck on light. Light is the easiest thing for them to visual process. None of this means anything to them, so they are up to the light all the time. The items, if they look at anything, it must be lighted items that they look at, or they don't pay any attention to it. For lighted items, they have more sustained visual attention, and light helps draw attention to their stronger and weaker fields while we take a look at light. So we might put a support in place like, okay, you like light, I'm going to put something up against a light box, because now I'm capitalizing on the fact that they like light, but trying to put something more meaningful in their world for them. In phase two, you see the light gazing really decreases, but light does still get their visual attention faster. Lighted items, they have more sustained attention to it. Light helps draw their visual attention to weaker fields. It's noticed at greater distances, and that backlighting really helps with visual motor. So when they get into phase two, they're able to reach in the environment because of recognition. They understand there's something there to reach for. So if I put something just out on a plain table, I get kind of this sweeping reach, whereas if I put it on backlighting, it's really, really direct. It really supports their visual motor skills. Really supports, this is a student of mine, really supports her understanding of her Mayor Johnson symbols on that lighted background. Really supports her eating. The occupational therapist said to me, you know, she finger feeds like this. She just eats perfectly fine just like this. But the occupational therapist said, how am I ever going to get to spoon use and fork use if she's not looking at what she's doing? So just by brainstorming between the two of us about what the occupational therapist wanted to do and how I could support the visual part of that, we just put a light box down, we covered it with a plastic tablecloth, and used a clear plate, and she absolutely started to look while she was eating, which was a great... Now she can... think about using a spoon or think about using a fork. And when you get into phase three, that backlighting really helps for discrimination of small features, and that backlighting really reduces visual fatigue. So backlighting, light in general, doesn't really ever disappear. It just changes throughout the needs according to where the child is. So there's a CDI range endorsement that Perkins is running. The CDI range is done incorrectly by a lot of people, and I think that it's a complex tool. and it took me a while to learn how to use it. Really, the endorsement only provides basic competence. It in no way means you're done learning about CDI, and I think that that's a really important thing. People will say, well, I'm CDI endorsed, so, you know, and that doesn't really mean that you have it all. You have got to keep your eye, your ears and your eyes aware of all the new things happening in CDI, because we have so few tools at this point. But it does give you that basic competence, but it should not be the end of your learning about CDI. So if you do that particular score that particular tool incorrectly, like I did when I gave that child a 9, what it leads to is the wrong programming for that child. What it leads to is my choosing the wrong materials, the wrong environmental supports. I was not given the right goals and objectives, and because of that, that child was not really going to improve their visual recognition. You know, I was where I was when I used that tool with that child at that point, but I've learned more, and I'm trying to be better at it. And that's really the answer, is just try to be better at what we have for tools. When we think about Dr. Dutton's survey, I find this to be a very, very helpful tool for kids that are reaching on their own or moving through space on their own. So some of the kids that might be higher on the CDI range. And he's looking again at the same things. He's looking at complexity, which Dr. Roman would talk about as some of these characteristics. He's thinking about visual fields. He's thinking about the impact of environmental movement. He's thinking about visual motor skills. And he also, which Dr. Roman does not do in hers, is talks about behaviors. So remember that kaleidoscopic view, and that poor child goes into the cafeteria and has a CDI meltdown. Kids' behavior is telling us an awful lot about how visually complex the world is or how overwhelming they are. So really understanding CDI better will help us understand children's behavior better, and putting supports in for their vision will really reduce their visual behaviors. Their outward behaviors. There's a wonderful TED Talk. It's a YouTube, a woman named Nicola McDowell. She's Scottish. She is standing up doing a presentation. She's reading her presentation, and she talks about the overwhelming nature of her visual of having CDI. She calls it a visual wilderness, and she talks about like trying to access a restaurant with friends. It's just really a very interesting YouTube presentation, if you can. Matt Teachin's work at What's the Complexity has two parts to it. This part here can be used with any student, and what it is a very systematic way that you look at the difficulty of the task, and you look at what environment that child is doing that task. So what you want is a balance. If that is a very, very, very difficult visual task, you want the environment with the most supports. You see what I'm saying? It's kind of a balance and really a systematic look. And he's got a whole framework that really helps you tease that out and then allows you to give a team, which I think is really important when you think about consult, gives the staff a list of exactly what kinds of environments certain tasks should be done in. Really, really a good portion of that. And the other is an image assessment. And this I find to be very interesting. I've used it for several of the children. So his first question is, does the child know their own dog, for instance, because that's visual recognition of a real three-dimensional thing, right? Then he wants to figure out, if I take a picture of that kid's dog, do they know that as a dog? Because you see, now you've taken the three-dimensional item that's usually in context, like your house, and you put it on a flat board and made a huge visual leap, a huge recognition leap. So does that child recognize their own dog in a picture? That's where he starts with the image assessment, but then he begins to really, really tease out some other things. So he wants to know, are real color photographs better for the child? Are realistic color drawings better? How about when I get to abstract color drawings? How about black and white? How about abstract black and white? And as I said before, you look at kids' worksheets, tons of abstract stuff, black and white, tons and tons. So he begins the assessment with the most difficult, back up there. He starts the assessment with the most difficult thing, and he just says to the child, what do you see? and then he works backwards. And he has, it is 13 items, and he does these five levels. So this would be one, he would say, what do you see? All of us would be able to say, I see a dog. We have dogness. We understand dogs. We understand what makes a dog a dog. What do you see? You see it's starting to look more realistic, but it's not colored, so it's hard. What do you see? It's colored. It has it has some details that color might support their understanding of what it is. But this realistic color would be easier. And then, of course, the real photograph of the dog would be the most interesting. So let me show you the results of my student, Olive, who I have at Perkins. I did the image assessment with her. She reads print. She reads very well. She's got some lower field issues. She's got some distance. She has some problems seeing anything at distance. She has CBI as her only issue. She does not have an ocular impairment. But she looks like she sees perfectly fine. So all the materials at her school are all ocular, unfortunately. Were all ocular. So they were giving her enlarged materials, or they were giving her high contrast, which were not her issues. Her issue was recognition. So if we started to tease out, when I showed her that abstract black and white line drawing, she only got 32% of them right. Those abstract black and white drawings are a frustrational visual task for her. When she went to the realistic black and white drawings, she got 56%, still falls within the frustrational part of visual processing. When I showed her the abstract color drawings, she got 53%. That's still at frustrational. Realistic color drawings, she got 72%. That's challenging. And realistic colored photographs, she got 77%, which is still considered challenging. So it's really great information. I could do this with Olive. She wasn't using a communication device, but could you see if you had a child you were working with that was using a communication device, you could really say to a teen, no, you can't use that. You have to use this. It's going to be really an important bit of information. The other part that's going to happen is that he's going to collect data on, do all kids in phase two have the same sorts of profile? And if they do, we could extrapolate that to the kids who really can't tell us what they see, which I think will be helpful helpful information for us when we serve kids that have devices or that don't have the ability to tell us what they see. For the steps to determining strategies, so people will say to me often, can you give me a strategy for CBI? And I always want to say to them, well, what are you trying to do? So the strategies really have to come from the assessment. They have to be based on the functional vision that we've teased out. And then that collaboration begins, like myself with the OT. What are you trying to do? You want to go to using a fork for food, for finger feeding? I know this about her visual skills. Let's incorporate that into your task and building that across the day. So this might be in place for a child who goes and stands at the door and doesn't know how to open the door. Accessing, getting some color highlighting might access a lunchbox. This might tell the child what part of the brush is accessible. This was an OT said, the child is just always going like this. I just want her hands to be away from her body. So we just put these color highlighted brushes that we knew she liked to feel off away from her body to do that. This child was incredibly fearful about getting off of a changing table. And just by putting her favorite color as a target, she more easily stepped down. This is how we open the refrigerator. This is kind of the sequence I think that some of Matt's stuff will lead us to, where if they're really recognizing their own toy, their own wrapper snapper, that we then mount that on a black background that's maybe 5x7. You see, this is starting to look like a picture, but it's still got that three-dimensional element. And then the picture itself has to be a picture of the real thing that supported that original looking. Here's just another one with another favorite toy. We want to think about perspectives for kids with CBI. How does something really look? If I laid this down on the table and took a picture like that, it would not be really a good perspective. I mean, look at the kinds of perspectives that end up in kids' books. I would not even say to myself when I saw this picture, ooh, that's a weird perspective. I would automatically know what it was. We have to make sure that just because we show kids things, that they really, really do understand it. So the interventions for color, movement, latency, all visual fields, all of those are based on what the child can do, and we've made those assessments. I'm just going to scoot through this because we're... What time do we finish?
12:15.
You get this PowerPoint afterwards. So program planning, so that's the other part. We have to take the information. How did all of us learn to see? We have access all the time. So this whole idea that as teacher of students with visual impairments, we can go in and see a child for 30 minutes a week and we're done, is really not going to work. We really have to embed this in the presentation methods, in the environments, in the materials, and having that high expectation for a visual improvement. We want to adapt environments to get rid of that distracting light, but also to use light. We want to limit the complexity, provide visual materials all the time. If we know a child can't see beyond 2 feet, and there's not something at 2 feet to look at all the time, that's not access. Limiting distracting movements. Giving presentations in the best field, using movement if we need it, light if we need it, at the best distance. Reducing complexity, you're hearing the same things over and over again that are really, really all based on predictability. It's based on their CDI range results. Color, you can see for the color of materials, whether they're need to be shiny, how familiar they are, whether they're visually recognized, and doing that very, very careful switch from three-dimensional to two-dimensional, and having high expectations. We often work with children who cannot move their bodies in space, or they can't reach accurately, or they have limited language, and they're not looking at things a lot of times. So because of that, we presume what they understand. And I think we have no way of knowing what they understand. We really don't. If you can't act on the world, how are you showing us what you understand? So I think presuming competence is really, really an important element of that. Do you see when we saw that little baby before, those two little babies before? If you had Demir and Omir sitting in front of you, and you were playing with the two of them, who are you going to start to play with more? The little boy on the left. Why? Eye contact, response. We need eye contact so much to let us know that people are paying attention. Like, if none of you were looking at me right now, I'd get nervous. Like, oh my gosh, no one's paying attention, or no one's understanding what I'm doing. We need that feedback, and we have to be aware that we need that feedback because kids with CDI aren't giving us that. So what other ways can we really look for that that feedback and their ideas that they understand? This is that embedded strategies across the day. So if I think about here's the kids' problems with color, movement, latency, what do I need to include for color for arrival? How about movement? How about latency? When I get to the calendar, where do I need to sit them? What colors do I use? Do I have to use movements? So really sitting with a team and thinking across the day of how you embed what you know about the child's visual skills into every portion of the day. And this really starts to get people thinking when you sit down and do things like that. So really that best practice is the knowledgeable and education staff. Again, that collaboration between medical and educational people is so essential. We can no longer be in our silos anymore. And we really need that parent involvement. They have a huge amount of information to give us, and we have to make sure that those are accurate assessments. That we have to make sure that the environments and the methodologies are based on that assessment, that the program planning is across the day, like I showed you that, that we want to teach all the expanded core curriculum areas when we deal with children with cortical visual impairment because they are children with visual impairment, and teaching advocacy. So someone like little Omir right now needs to understand why it takes him longer to find something on the page. We have to say to him, you have CDI. CDI means you have difficulty with these things. Here's a complex page. Let's think about what strategies you could use to make that non-complex. Teach him to do the strategies. That's very empowering for him to learn that. That's advocacy, which falls right under the expanded core areas. And for all of us to really consider learning more about CDI, as I've said probably 6 times today, that we can't be done. We have to just really, really keep going when we think about CDI. The danger in the field is the teacher who knows nothing about CDI and the overconfident teacher who says, oh, I took a class or I went to a weekend workshop. That's not enough, as we all know. This is a complex thing, and we really, in order to serve our children to the best of our abilities, we have to keep on really learning more. So we're all on that path, and I really thank you so much for coming today. And let's see if I'm going to just have my whole perspective.